This Restorative Justice Life is a production of Amplify RJ. Follow us on all social media platforms at Amplify RJ, sign up for our email list, and check out our website at amplifyrj.com to stay up to date on everything we have going on. Make sure you're subscribed to this feed on whatever platform you're listening on right now so you don't miss an episode. And finally, we'd love it if you left us a rating and review. It really helps us literally amplify this work. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to This Restorative Justice Life, the podcast that explores how the philosophy, practices, and values of restorative justice apply to our everyday lives. I'm your host, David Ryan Barcega Castro Harris, all five names for the ancestors, and I'm the founder of Amplify RJ. On this podcast, I talk with RJ practitioners, circle keepers, and others doing this work about how this way of being has impacted their lives. You're getting an extra episode this week because it's Black History Month, and I wanted to share this conversation with Demonte Wesley, who will be leading our upcoming workshops on the history of Black abolition movements from chattel slavery to the new Jim Crow. Demonte was one of the first people to come into our Intro to RJ workshops last spring, and since then, they've been an integral part of our community. In addition to leading this upcoming workshop series, they also co-host a group on imagining abolition in youth-centered spaces. It's free and open to everyone. Links to everything in the show notes. Special announcement for today's episode. I'm so excited to be introducing our new producer, Elise Martin Smith. Hey, Elise.
Hey, thank you so much for inviting me today.
I am so excited to have you, not only because it's taking a lot of work off of me, but you're someone who came to Amplify RJ through one of our workshops, and you're a high school student. When I was watching back the recording of the workshop, I had seen you there, and I was like, wow, who is this person who is showing so much wisdom, showing so much initiative by showing up here? And I really just wanted to have this conversation about how you could get involved. Since then, you've done a couple of things with us. What's one thing that really excites you about coming onto this project?
I'm so excited to be able to share questions and my thoughts on these amazing people's stories, and to be able to continue to listen to all of these experts.
And we're excited to get your insights. It's always good to have multiple perspectives. This work is applicable to so many people in so many different places, and we're really glad to have you on board. You'll be hearing more from Elise in future episodes, but now let's get into our conversation with Demonte. Welcome, Demonte. Who are you?
I am a facilitator of childhood education.
Who are you?
I am a person who feels a deep responsibility to complete and continue the work of my ancestors.
Mm. Who are you?
I am a student and a servant of life.
Who are you?
I am a devoted friend and sibling.
Mm-hmm. Who are you?
I am a Black queer Southerner, and I'm very proud of being from the South.
Mm-hmm. Who are you?
I am a person trying every day to be in good relationship with the world and the people around me.
I think this is the last one. Who are you?
I am a student of restorative justice.
Well, it is so good to have you here. You're the second person on the podcast who came to us through, you know, the work that we've been doing with Amplify RJ. Helen was the first, and Helen is our teammate with Decolonize Your Classroom. You're doing work with us at Decolonize Your Classroom now, really coming up soon. We have these workshops on the history of Black abolition movements from chattel slavery to Jim Crow, and then you're going to be facilitating learning around practicing abolition in the classroom, as you shared. But before all that, you're a person who I've gotten to know over the last few months, and it's been a real privilege. So it's always good to check in to the fullest extent of the question, how are you?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I think I'm good. Being in online learning right now, we're almost at the 1 year mark of being in the quarantine, like being in online learning. And while like I'm glad to be able to like know that I'm safe and my kids are safe, it does take a lot out of you. It is, it's pretty exhausting. So I'm just trying to, keep my head above water and stay focused as much as possible. I'm in a time in my life of like transition and planning to transition. But I'm okay. I'm physically pretty good. I'm in good spirits. Can't complain. I can complain, but I won't complain.
That's fair. For those of you who didn't pick that up, as a facilitator of childhood learning, many people call that a teacher, an educator, right? So those are the kids that Des Moines is referring to. You're in a unique position where in the traditional way that your school operates, you like live and work alongside your students. How has it been not living with them this year?
Yeah, it's really weird because like I literally live with, I'm the dorm parent for the high school boys dorm at my school, and it's a really big building. And so I'm just in my apartment in this really big building, and this building creaks. So it's really weird. It's really weird. And like my interactions in the dorm aren't like always, they're not the interactions that I have in the classroom, right? Where we're having like deep, meaningful conversation, but it is some of the most fun that I have. They like teach me Yu-Gi-Oh and dances and things like that. It's really fun. So I'm really missing that.
Yeah, for sure. How have you continued community with your students in COVID times?
Yeah, so it's been pretty difficult because there's something about these machines that we sit on all day that just like, it can suck the life out of you. And our students feel that as well. So I try to be like really intentional in the classroom to like build in time for like checking in. So I've started doing like using Jamboard, Google Jamboard, doing like virtual. So we like everyone's name is in a circle and we virtually pass a talking piece and we answer different questions and that's how we discuss. And yeah, so like reserving that time so that we can connect with each other at the human level and not be so worried about like getting through curriculum, which seems like what everyone else in the world is really, really focused on when it comes to kids. They're just worried that they're learning the things. And they are, but it's important, I think, to make sure that I'm also just talking to them and they get the opportunity to just talk to me and to each other.
Yeah, for sure. And like, how do you balance the expectations of like, no, learning still has to happen. We need to learn the you're not teaching ABC, but like, we need to learn like critical reading skills on top of like still getting to connect with folks.
Yeah. I don't know how much I want to or can, I mean, I guess I will, but like get into my sort of wackadoo ideas about education.
That's why you're here.
I guess that's true. I will say that I don't know. I don't think there's a whole lot. I don't want to focus on the things that we have to learn. I don't really believe in that, the have to learn. I think that there are certainly things that there is joy in learning. And I want that to be the focus right now for my kids. Like, the world is, like, falling apart. And here's the truth. We don't live in a just society, right? I think we can all agree that. If we did, education would be the most important thing for kids. Like, it would be, I think it is the most important thing, but it would literally be on their list of things in their life. It would be number one. But because we don't live in a just society, I won't say education, schooling is, in my mind, not number one among those things. It is not the most important thing right now, especially, if ever. I have kids who are like worried about keeping up the household. I have kids who are helping raise their siblings. I have kids who are dealing with like their own health and the health of like grandparents. So like this like obsession with being in the schoolhouse and like upholding the structures of schooling, I don't buy it. So yeah, I think to reiterate, my biggest focus is just to help them maintain the joy of learning right now and not worry so much about like, these are the standards that you have to meet. And we can talk about standards all day long too.
Well, maybe this will lead into that, but I'm curious from your perspective, how do you differentiate between schooling and education or schooling and learning?
So right now there's a lot of talk about learning loss. Like kids are not learning again because they are not in the schoolhouse. They are not learning. But kids are by their like very nature just learning always. They're learning through being, they're learning through play, they're learning through conversation. They are learning. And that is what's important to me, right? The gaining of new knowledge, the creation of new knowledge. That is learning. That's education, right? Applying that new knowledge. Schooling is sort of the sum of all of the structures that make up the U.S. education system. So again, like being in the schoolhouse, standards, assessments, the teaching of capitalist ethics, like learning how to sit still and follow directions. That to me is what I mean when I say schooling. It's all of that. And I think even like the schoolhouse is showing right now just how much all of that isn't really important. I mean, last year, so many like states, I have friends who teach in Louisiana, I'm in Texas. But, you know, standardized testing, people were canceling standardized tests left and right, right? Mm-hmm. So this thing that we sort of like now take for granted, I took standardized tests when I was in school. I don't know if you did. Did you take standardized tests?
Yeah, of course.
Right. Yeah. So like this thing that we take for granted that like it just has to happen, right? It is synonymous with the education experience. They're already canceling it. So it just peaks in my mind like, okay, so you admit that that is not a permanent thing, right? That's not something that has to happen. What are the other things that don't necessarily have to happen? And how can we use this moment as an opening to shake things up?
Yeah. And learn things that are relevant, right? You've learned a lot of different ways. I mean, you have your bachelor's in English literature, women's gender studies, a minor in African American studies, right? You learned that through schooling, but you've learned so much about this work, quote unquote, this work of restorative justice, abolition, transformative justice. Outside of all of that, the quote comes to mind, right? You know, they're never going to teach you how to dismantle. They're never going to give you the skills to dismantle. I'm butchering that quote.
Asada Shakur, no one's going to give you the education that you need to overthrow them.
Yes.
I think that's right.
Right. And you've learned so much about this outside of schooling, right? I know you've known this work for a while, even into like your teenage years. How did you get started doing this work?
So in high school, I had to have been, I think like a sophomore. I was doing like a research paper about the death penalty. In Texas, in my hometown at least, but I kind of think it's a Texas thing. High school students have to do something that's called term theme, where like every in the spring semester of every year, you write this big research paper. Again, maybe that was just in my hometown, but it kind of feels like a Texas thing. Anyway, so my term theme that year was around like the death penalty and other things having to do with like prisons. And I can't remember exactly. And so, you know, I was talking in class one day about how I didn't think that the death penalty should exist. And like my teacher sort of made an offhand comment that like there's people who don't even believe that prisons should exist. And didn't really go deeper into that. But I thought that that was an interesting idea. So I did some searching and I found a blog post by who I later realized was Maryam Kaba. And yeah, that sort of like piqued my interest at first. And then when I got into college, I met a group of anarchists who like sort of gave me a formal education. A formally informal education in like abolition and what it means to be a prison abolitionist.
Yeah. What does that mean for you?
To be a prison abolitionist?
I mean, I can pull up like a critical resistance definition, but everybody else can Google that as well. What does that mean for you?
Yeah. I think recently... And I keep saying it to, like, anyone who will listen. I think recently what abolition means for me is, like, a steadfast dedication to, like, life and the preciousness of life, right? Ruth Wilson Gilmore always says, where life is precious, right? Under an abolitionist framework, meaning that there are no cages, no place where life is not precious. And I think, yeah, I think that's what abolition is for me. There are so many just institutions that are under white supremacy and capitalism that are like hell-bent on death, hell-bent on the death of Black people in particular, Indigenous folks, disabled people, queer and trans people. And abolition for me is about building a world where life is precious and where those death institutions are not even imaginable, like are not possible.
Yeah, that makes, I mean, that makes so much sense to me. I'm curious, like, how does that belief in abolition land you in education as a profession?
In a couple of ways. So like, first and foremost, so what I went to college to do was to be a literature professor. I wanted to teach African American literature, which is, you know, wonderful. That's valuable. I loved my literature professors. But there was a moment, I really don't want to step on anyone's toes, but there was a moment where that just felt like not real. It sort of felt like people sort of talking around solutions, but like not ever actualizing them. At least in my like younger brain, that's what it felt like. And so I wanted to do something that felt more real. And I remember, even though I have like a complicated feelings about my education, like my K through 12 education now in hindsight, during K through 12 education, like I love school. Like I love doing it. I was by just about every metric a good student. I got good grades or whatever. But I also remember like finding the Maryam Kaba blog post. School was a place where I was introduced to new ideas. This is the first time I read Toni Morrison and James Baldwin on my own. It was not assigned, of course, but so I was thinking like, okay, school. And then also thinking about how school is a place where we sort of get set on the path of life. It's a major machine for socialization. It's how we learn so much about the world, including how we learn, or how we are taught, I should say, that like punishment and prisons and police are sort of like permanent parts of society. And so that also holds that like the school is a place where critical reimagining can happen. But I learned very quickly that there's only so much you can do inside a classroom. There's a lot you can do inside a classroom. But abolition in the school, abolition as it relates to the prison industrial complex, really depends on changing everything, right? Like, carceral society, carceral logics penetrate just about everything in our society, as do, I mean, carceral logics are white supremacist, capitalist, racist, and just like those things, white supremacy, capitalism, it penetrates everything. So while I still think that, like, education and the classroom are critical places where we can start reimagining, I also think that a lot has to change with just how we do education in order for that process to really happen. I don't know if that answered your question, but...
Yeah, partially, right? It's part of it is that, you know, that's where people are, and, like, we need to use, like, all the vehicles that we can in order to get these ideas out there to help people reimagine. Something that is coming to mind is, in your introduction, you said you see yourself as someone who is continuing the work of your ancestors. What does that mean? Or what is that work?
I think the work of my ancestors, since the time that they were brought to this country against their will, has been about affirming their humanity, like fighting tooth and nail to take their humanity, right? Not just to be recognized as human, or not just to be given the title of human, but to really, like, take that title. So I think that I see, I don't want to say I see my work, because I don't know what that means, but I see my life as, like, doing that work, like, for myself and for people that I care about, like, doing the work of, like, humanizing myself, like, taking by any means necessary my right to humanity. What that looks like, I guess, concretely, is abolition, which for some people doesn't seem concrete. I think it is. I think abolition is, it is not just a blueprint, certainly, but it is concrete, right? There are concrete aspirations of abolition. So yeah, like, dismantling prisons, right? I cannot myself be fully human while prisons exist, because there is always a place for me. There's always a cell waiting for me and for people who I love, a place where we will be further dehumanized, right? And so, like, advocating for prison abolition is part of that lineage of work that my ancestors started.
Yeah. Is there a specific ancestor who has taught this to you, or you feel connected to in doing this work?
The person that's coming to mind right now, though I don't know that this is, had you asked me, like, if we were doing this tomorrow and you asked me tomorrow, I don't know if this would be the same answer. But the answer that's popping into my mind right now is David Walker. Because David Walker, like, in many ways was just, like, a normal person who just decided to write his appeal, right? Like, he wasn't a Frederick Douglass, right? Mm-hmm. He wasn't a person who is, like, now renowned as, like, an orator and a, yeah, like, I think Frederick Douglass is probably the most famous, like, abolitionist in terms of enslavement. But David Walker, I don't know, there's something there in sort of just the mundane human aspect of abolition, of just being a person who knows that this world doesn't work for you.
I just had to Google who David Walker was. For those of us who don't know, can you explain a little bit about who he is and what he wrote?
So David Walker was a merchant, had a used clothing store, as Rita Dove, the poet who wrote a poem about David Walker, reminds us, on Brattle Street. Yeah, he was honestly a family man. Started a used clothes store. And wrote what is now sort of known as David Walker's Appeal, which is a sort of appeal to free and enslaved Black people alike to take up arms against enslavement. And so, yeah, I think that I think David Walker right now appeals to me because I don't myself feel like a extraordinary person, right? I am not a person who will go on talking tours like a Frederick Douglass, but I'm just a person in the schoolhouse trying to do my thing. But I can also still sort of like step in and say my piece because it matters to my life in a real way, right? Like I grew up with people, I have people in my family who are currently or were incarcerated. And like so much about carceral society structures my life and the lives of people that I love. So even though I'm not, and probably never will be, do not desire to be, a person who is sort of like known as a prominent abolitionist, whatever that means, or what do they call them? Like a public intellectual. I can still say my piece. I can still come on my friend's podcast and say things about abolition.
I would argue that you are publicly intellectualizing, so be careful. Yeah. And for context for folks, David Walker was born free, right? In 1789. Was a black man, and was writing about all these issues until his death in the early 1800s. This is before the Civil War.
Yes. Death by suspicious. There's like rumors that he was poisoned to death. I don't know. There's no, of course, no like official records of that, but that is sort of the story.
Yeah, I'm glad you called him into this space because he's one of the many people you're going to be highlighting in our upcoming workshops on the history of Black abolition movements from chattel slavery, right, till the new Jim Crow, which we're experiencing now. What can people expect if they're engaging in that workshop?
I think that people can expect, I hope that people can expect to learn about people that they might not have heard about. I think, and really the work of a black woman historian by the name of Kelly Carter Jackson has really helped me think about this a lot. And the idea, especially as it relates to chattel slavery and the people who are doing abolition work around chattel slavery, the names that are often brought up, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman was known to carry a piece, but like for the most part, the names of abolition that we know are often either black people who like used the tactics of sort of like the moral appeal and not necessarily like a call to arms or a call to violence, or like white folks who did the same thing. So people might be familiar with the name of William Lloyd Garrison, right? As a white abolitionist. But so I hope that for people, we can sort of like unearth together a history of black people centering themselves, centering their liberation, and working on behalf of themselves and other black people towards their own liberation. And I hope that we're able to sort of see the connected history of abolition movements. So we're sort of going to move through abolition as it related to chattel slavery, enslavement of black people here in the United States. Then we're going to move past like the civil rights era into what many scholars mark as like the start of the anti-prison movement as it related to like black folks. So around figures like Angela Davis and Assata Shakur and George L. Jackson and other people who were fighting for black liberation and faced repression from the state, from the carceral state. And sort of see like how those two things go hand in hand, right? How the fight for black liberation is met with that repression. And so why prison abolition is so integral to the fight for black liberation. And then sort of moving into like more current times with conversations still around prison abolition and the abolition of the police, and especially highlighting voices of black, queer, and trans people, both on the inside of carceral systems and who are advocating on the outside. Again, I think that's a history that maybe people are less familiar with. So, yeah, I look forward to digging into those things, discovering new things with people.
Yeah, and I think what's really important is, like, making the connections between what people experienced then and what, in many ways, we're experiencing now. Michelle Alexander is famous for writing the new Jim Crow and tying, you know, old Jim Crow laws, right, mm-hmm. To the way that the prison industrial complex has been built up now. But there are other ways that this has impacted us. This is beyond just prisons and policing, right? You talked about how abolition is about, like, you know, our everyday lives. Even, like, when I talk about restorative justice, you know, I talk about relationships, and the first relationship that we have is the relationship with ourselves. How are we the police to ourselves? How are we the police to our communities? How are we using power over and being hyper-judgmental, hyper-critical of folks? Like, those carceral logics, how are we punitive to ourselves and others? Like, those are also, what was the phrase you used? Death-making, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, I want to give credit to Miriam Kaba. She calls prison and all of the prison industrial complex a collection of death-making institutions.
Yeah, absolutely. And Miriam Kaba, I don't know if you name-checked her before, but she's another person who has definitely influenced me and will be spending some time learning about and from in the pre-session learning for the workshop, as well as the workshop itself. How have you, since the reignition of the struggle for racial justice, been taking care of yourself while still doing this work?
I haven't done a good job of it, I have to be honest. And I never have really done a great job of, like, prioritizing myself and my health. I'm trying to be better. I'm still in the process of becoming. Yeah, it's been hard. I think the most consistent way that I've been trying to take care of myself is by building community, like forging like lines of connection with people. Amplify RJ has been probably the primary space of me doing that. It's introduced me to just some of the most brilliant people I've ever talked to. Learning more about circle work has been healing in many ways. But yeah, sort of like the other things, making sure I'm getting my vitamin D and walking and, like, developing a consistent care practice, I have not been the best. Yeah. I won't police myself about that, but.
Yeah. I wanted to shout you out for all that you've contributed to the Amplify RJ community. You are one of those brilliant people who have come through our space, right? That's partially why you're here and why we're collaborating on the workshop. But, you know, you're also the host of one of our community groups, which is about imagining abolition in youth-centered spaces. You co-host that with Stephanie Sarantos. Tell folks about that space, what you do there, and how people can get involved.
I sort of, I sometimes vulgarly call it a teacher support group, which sometimes that's what it becomes, right? It becomes a place where we get together and sort of like talk about our frustrations. And those times are beautiful. But it's also really a place for us to... I sort of hinted earlier that when it comes to abolition in school, what I'm really talking about is the abolition of the system of schooling itself. That's what I mean when I say it. I can't speak for anyone else. But so this space allows us to come together as people who are mostly teachers, but other people who are just engaged with youth often, to imagine how we can transform our relationships with young people, how we can use our positions to transform the spaces that we are consistently in relationship with young people in. So in the schoolhouse, in after school programs, whatever it is that we're doing. Because truthfully, right, like if we are going to abolish carceral society, it starts with us, certainly, the adults, but it also starts with kids. like it starts with the assumptions that we teach kids to have or that we encourage them to have, right? So I think the moment that we realize that we should go to an authority figure to police harm or to police things going on within our communities is largely in the school, right? We mm-hmm. learn to go tell the teacher or whatever the case may be. Or we know the consequence ladder, right? Punishment on the consequence ladder. So I think if we are truly going to talk about building something that serves us better than carceral society, we also have to think about how that impacts schools, how schooling is implicated in that.
You were sharing with me this last week when you met that you all were doing this exercise or activity where you were imagining a truly liberated youth-centered space. I'm not going to ask you to share what the group came up with. What does that look like for you?
Yeah. Sort of at the foundation of it is true co-creation and solidarity between everyone in that space. So between the adults and the young people who are in that space. It means not condescending to young people. It means like not coming to young people with a set agenda of like, this is what you need to learn in order to be a member of our society. But instead inviting young people to imagine with us, like we have all of these possibilities for building a better, freer, more just, more caring world. What does that look like for you? And then like exploring that together. I also think it means like giving ourselves as adults, as facilitators of the learning, and like encouraging in kids an analysis of the world as it currently is in a way that like lets kids have Dr. Goldie Muhammad uses the word criticality, like having a critical understanding of the world. I think that that is important. Yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to think of other things.
I think like such a big part of this is like what you described. It's not about the certain structures, the certain activities that are happening. It is that the solidarity, doing things with folks instead of for them or to them, right? Mm-hmm. Making sure that like our adultism isn't coming into play, right? It's not that we as adults don't know anything and can't contribute to the space, right? But our opinions, our experiences aren't more important than the desires and the knowledge of young people.
Yeah, I think often teachers are tasked with being gatekeepers for gatekeepers of knowledge and gatekeepers to like the next step of life, right? We sort of decide, are you ready to move on? And for me, my work in education, or like my desire in this work, is to not be a gatekeeper. I don't want to like set up the goalpost or the standards that you have to achieve or that you have to climb over. I want to be a guide on the bridge, right? I want to be the bridge itself. I want to help you reach your own expectations of your life, not my expectations of you.
So what does that look like in your classroom? Because you do work within a system where you are giving grades, right?
Yeah, grades are the bane of my existence. They should not exist. They don't, much like prisons and police, grades don't do what we think that they do. They just don't. I do work in a place that does grades, but I try as much as possible to give students sort of control over their own grade. That might sound weird, but like students get to decide what projects that they will be engaged in, right? I sort of set the framework as I have to, right? This class is about literature, so we got to be reading books, right? But do we have to be reading books? Literature could be a whole bunch of other things. And how you want to engage with what you're reading and what we're learning, you get to decide that. I know so many people who, as I, when I decided to get my degree in English literature, so many people are like, ugh, I hated English in school because we had to do all that writing. I wonder how many people would like actually love it as a subject if they didn't have to do that, if they could engage with it in a different way. And so like giving students like the space to engage with the work as they want to, and then sort of talk to me about what their expectations of that is, or what their expectations are, how they met their expectations, what they would do differently to better meet their expectations. And then sometimes it literally looks like them telling me, this is what, this is the grade that I earned and why, and me putting that grade in the grade book.
Yeah. Yeah. What are, what's an example of like some of the projects that they've taken? You teach social studies and English, right? Literature?
Yeah. So often, really, it looks like me just saying, okay, here we got done reading this book. What resonates for you? What comes up for you? So I've had students, so we read The Leavers by Lisa Coe. And that is about an Asian American kid who gets adopted by a white family, who changes his name after his wife, or after his mother sort of abandons him. And so I had students who, from that book, became really interested in like adoption in the foster care system and decided to do a project studying that. I had a student who is himself, he's Asian American, Vietnamese American, and wanted to study more about like the culture and issues impacting him. Yeah, I'm trying to think of other things. But yeah, it's really just like you come into this space with knowledge. You come into this space with a point of view. You come into this space, not a blank canvas. So what do you have to offer to the space? And like making space for kids to give that, I think, yeah, is what I tried to do.
Yeah.
I'm imperfect at it.
Yeah, of course. It's you said, you know, you're still becoming. Mm-hmm. I'm curious how that aligns with, or doesn't align with, like, all right, now it's test time. You have to take the standardized test.
I am lucky that I don't work in a context where my kids take a standardized test. Mm-hmm. So that frees me up a bit. And to be quite honest, I think that this is easier said than done, and I'll admit that. But I think that so long as we continue to comply with the sort of assumptions that schools are based on, right? That there's these goalposts that you have to reach. And when I say we, I'm talking about teachers. If we continue to do that, if we continue to say, okay, these are the goalposts, you have to do it, you like, then that is what it will always be. I like talk to so many, like, I think well-intentioned people who are just like, I have to, this is what happens. Like when I get observed, these are the things that I'm observed on. I have to make sure that I'm teaching to these standards. In some places, the scores that your kids get on standardized testing determines a raise, like your pay. Mm-hmm. So it's all very real, right? But for my money, and this could be because I'm 24 years old and I'm naive and all of that, I will admit that. But I also think that nothing changes until we change it. Like until we sort of like do some refusal.
And James Baldwin, right? Nothing can be changed until it's faced.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think, yeah, what do you do when it comes time for standardized testing? I would say you organize with parents and have them keep their kids out of school on days where there's standardized tests so that we can start thinking critically about who is served by a standardized test. I don't think our students are. I think most people in education, I won't say most people, but many people in education would admit that standardized testing does not serve our students. So who does it serve? I think that that's the critical question. And it's one that Stephanie taught me of like asking always, does this serve us? And if it doesn't, how do we get to something that will?
Yeah.
But yeah.
I think there's like this circle principle of consensus, right?
Mm.
Where your no does not mean no, I'm going to take my ball and go home, right? Your no is, no, this doesn't work for me. This is what will.
Mm-hmm.
How can we make this happen? Right? We don't get to walk. Most people don't have the privilege to walk away from school systems, right? People don't mm-hmm. have the luxury of homeschooling their kids. People have jobs, right? Public education, as it exists, will continue to exist for a very long time. And like, what are the things that we can do to make the changes to make it more equitable, make it serve our needs? And yeah. And I think like teachers are such a big part of this, right? Teachers are, I'll say that teachers are oppressed within the mm-hmm. construct of public education as it exists. And so what are the things that teachers need to do to get to the place where all of this serves them in the fullness of their humanity as well? I mean, especially now thinking about all the people who are fortunately, I think, being pushed to the front of COVID vaccine lines, but there's so many people who have been forced to be in classrooms mm-hmm. in less than safe conditions. There's got to be a better way forward.
Right. And yeah, there has to be a better way forward. And something that I'm thinking about a lot right now that I don't have an answer for is, how do teachers make critical interventions in the classroom to make classrooms spaces that better serve students and make classrooms into like life-giving places, right? More than they are now, without redeeming what is, in my mind, an irredeemable system. Again, mm-hmm. I don't think everyone is going to agree with me. I think there are some people who believe that the American education system can be saved, and you know, I give that to you. I don't believe that. I don't believe that it is a system worth saving. Much like prisons and policing, in my mind, these are not systems that are worth saving. They're not systems that are worth reforming. They're not systems that can be reformed in a way that will flip them into, from death-making institutions into life-giving institutions. So like, how do we, who are doing like the frontline work in the classroom, make those interventions, yes, without sort of like saving the system? How do I implement abolitionist ways of being in the classroom without sort of saying like, okay, now school is a good safe place because my classroom is a good safe place?
Yeah. It reminds me, I'm going to shout out another podcast. It's called Ergo. It's based out of Chicago. Daniel and Damon have been documenting so much of what's been happening in this movement since you know, before this last year. I think they're 200 some episodes in. But mm-hmm. this last fall, they did this series called The Abolition Suite, and E-Viewing was one of the people who was a contributor to that. And, you know, she does talk about wrestling with this idea, are public schools redeemable,
mm-hmm.
right? And I don't think that there is an answer. Well, as someone who is not a public school, currently engaged in public school, I don't think it's my place to make that judgment. I also don't have children who are engaged in public schooling. But it definitely has to be an approach that is both and, right? Because our people are still inside the system, mm-hmm. right? And we need to be imagining what's coming next. We need to be building what's coming next that will continue to serve us. The follow-up to your History of Black Abolition Movements workshops, which are going to be February 6th and 27th mm-hmm. from 9 to 11 a.m. Pacific time, if you're listening to this in the year 2021, that's happening in February. But starting in March, you're starting a series on practicing abolition in the classroom. What is that going to look like?
Yeah. So, yeah, again, thinking about the things that teachers and folks working directly with youth in classrooms can do right now before we tear everything down. What can we do right now? I think we're going to talk about how we can, again, start challenging assumptions that a lot of schools and classrooms are based on. that sort of lead into carceral society. So punishment, for example, which again is, I think, something that is taken for granted. Like, we just know that if you do something wrong in a classroom, you get a conduct cut, or you get your popsicle stick moved down, or whatever the case may be. Get your parents called, or you get the paddle. I don't know if there's any place that still uses corporal punishment, but yeah. So, like, again, if we, and I'm thinking about Kay Prentice's episode of the podcast when she was talking about how she and Carolyn Boyce Watkins came up with the 7 assumptions as a way to sort of like set the framework. Like, if you, in order to understand what we're talking about, you need to understand these 7 assumptions that we operate from. So I think in order to understand what I mean when I say like abolitionist schooling, right, or abolitionist teaching, it might not be what other people mean when they say that. But what I mean is seeing the school, seeing the classroom as a site that produces and reproduces carceral logics, then we have to know that this is a critical place where we disrupt and dismantle those logics. So together over the course of this series, we're looking at that. We're looking at how do we disrupt carceral logics. We're looking at like, what are the ways of shifting pedagogical practice in a more abolitionist direction, right? In a way that is more about co-creation and problem posing and again, investing students with this criticality. And then we're also going to think about like being an abolitionist teacher, if like you want to take that on, that is scary work. So back to that Assata Shakur quote, if nobody's going to give a kid or anyone the education that they need to overthrow them, then no one's going to pay us as teachers to give kids the education that they need to overthrow them. So like, how do we in our places, our spaces, start coalition building and building that collective courage to sort of like start implementing these things and start doing the transformation that we can where we are. I don't have all of the answers. I have all of the ideas, and I'm excited for building community with educators and facilitators of childhood education all across the country to sort of start thinking about this together.
And I am so excited to be learning alongside you, learning from you. We've learned so much here. The links to sign up for all the workshops will be in the show notes here. Is there anything else you want to share before we move into the questions that everybody answers?
I don't think so. I think I'm good.
All right. So, define restorative justice.
Ooh, define restorative justice. I kind of just want to say your definition that you give, but I'm gonna say that restorative justice is a way of being that seeks to bring one into good relationship with the world and people and non-people.
Absolutely. Without saying schools, what is one place or situation you wish people really knew this work?
Okay, one place that I really do, or like one like set of relationships where I wish that people really knew this work, and I do think that people are beginning to learn this work, but it's like with neighbors, like with people that are not your family, but like that you see every day. I think so much of the violence that Black people, people of color face at the hands of the police, many instances might have been like avoided had there been an ethic of like neighborism, of like knowing who your neighbors are and intervening and things like that.
Says the person who lives in a creepy old empty apartment building. Yeah, it's hard, right? Especially in pandemic times. I moved into the house that I live in now in April of this year, and so you know, when we were looking at the house, like, you know, we talked to both of the neighbors, and since then it's like, hey, yeah. I'm going to say hi, like, over the fence, like, very distanced. It's tough in the world that we live in, but, you know, it's so necessary because, to your point, right, that's where the police get called, mm-hmm. right, when it could have been a conversation.
Right.
Yeah. You get to sit in circle with four people, living or dead. Who are they, and what do you talk about?
This is hard.
You knew it was coming.
I did. But I didn't want to think about it beforehand. I should have. I think I would sit with my granny, and it would be a... No, I would sit with my granny. I would sit with Toni Morrison. You said four people?
Four.
Okay, my granny, Toni Morrison, Bell Hooks, and Paulo Freire.
What do we talk about?
Cooking, because I don't know how, and I want them to teach me. I mean, other things, of course, like liberation and what their lives were like, and what it would be a lot of storytelling. But I also just want to know about these people who I sort of like look up to. What did they cook? How did they cook?
for sure. What's a restorative practice that you're really leaning into for yourself?
If it counts, circle. Yeah.
How has that been playing out in digital space?
In digital space, yeah. It's been interesting. So I'm learning circle, again, with Stephanie and, Dr. Pamela Taylor, and just like sitting in circles as they pop up. It's been interesting, but it's also been really cool. I think there's probably been some reluctance on behalf of people who like knew circle as a process before this moment to do it digitally. Like there's been some resistance because I think there is something about doing it in person that cannot be replicated online. Mm-hmm. But I also just think that, like, circle is a living process. It's a process, like, about, like, living and being in relationship with people. And as the ways that we live and the ways that we, you know, are with each other changes, I think that circle also is going to shift and change. So it's been, I don't know, it's still been really impactful for me. I don't have much to compare it to, like, in terms of like real life, because I'm starting my journey online, but it has still been like really impactful, shattering in some ways, because there's that thing that like people who have sat in circle a lot say that like the circle really starts once you leave circle. And that's true, but there's something about being in circle. There's like a realization that I'll talk from the eye. There's a realization that I had that like, I don't know. It's how I want to spend most, if not all of my time. Just like being that circle way of doing things.
Yeah. Call back to episode 4 with Helen.
Come on.
That circle way.
Come on, call back.
What's one thing you want everybody listening to this podcast to know?
I want everyone to know that if you have something to say that you think is worth hearing, you should say it. Like, I don't think that you have to wait for the time or the space, or like, you don't have to wait to be Angela Davis. You don't have to wait to be Frederick Douglass. You don't have to wait to be like these prominent people. And I think honestly, we would do ourselves some good to do away with that sort of model of Black leadership that is sort of so like tokenized, like these are the people. I think, yeah, we could do ourselves a lot of good if we sort of like democratize the voices. And I think like social media helps with that. But yeah, if you think that there is something worth saying that is liberatory and life-giving and all of that, you should say it.
Well, thanks for being a model of that by being here. I wish we could close on that, but there are still two more questions. Oh, who's one person that I should have on this podcast and you have to help me get them on?
Oh, easy. I'm gonna say Stephanie because she is a tremendous storyteller. And if you do nothing else, you can just sit around and like tell stories all the time. She has like so much experience. She has just done so many different things in our lives. She's very interesting. And then Dr. Pamela Taylor, because I don't know. She is a person who like loves Circle, and you can just tell. Like she is, I don't want to call her a nerd, but like she is like very like ravenous for like the learning and being in Circle. And she is certainly as much of an expert about Circle as anyone can be, but she seems like she's always learning more about it. So yeah. Mm. You know both of those people.
I know both of those people. That's so true. Finally, where can people support you and your work in the ways that you want to be supported?
Sure. Well, you can come to the workshops, which are linked below, right?
In the show notes.
Yeah, they're in the show notes. Linked below. I was raised by YouTube.
For the one video clip that goes up on YouTube, yes, they'll be linked below. And I guess in most podcast players, they are below. You just have to swipe up.
Yeah. So you can go to those workshops, build community with me and others who are in those spaces. We can swap emails once you're there. I'm not really on social media. I think that's how I'd want you to support. And learn the work, learn what it means to be an abolitionist, and then just start like repping that. Like take that into your being, study it, learn like in your context what it means to be an abolitionist, and then do that, because it takes all of us. It's gonna take everyone getting involved in the work. So,
yeah. So I thought that was going to be the last question. I'm going to ask you one more, but I also want to plug the Amplify RJ community gatherings. Okay. The Des Moines co-hosts with Stephanie this space, Imagining Abolition in Youth-Centered Spaces. That'll be linked below. Follow Decolonize Your Classroom, which is the platform along with Amplify RJ that is hosting these upcoming workshops. Again, linked below. And the question that I want to close out on, you've read so many people. You've gotten resources and learning from so many people. As you gave that charge to folks to, you know, learn this work and do it themselves, who is one person who they should go Google right now?
One person that they should go Google right now. I referenced her earlier, and I don't think it is one that like a name that most people know. So Kelly Carter Jackson, Black woman historian, again, like zooming into the work of Black abolitionists, I would definitely. She put out a book in 2019 called Force and Freedom. So look that up.
All right. Well, you heard them. Maybe we'll get a link to that below as well. Thank you so much, Des Moines Day, for sharing with us. Really looking forward to your workshops. Everyone else, take care. Oh, this is a bonus episode. So there's another episode coming out in a couple of days. We'll see you soon. Like what you heard? Please subscribe, rate, review, and share this podcast on whatever platform you're using right now. It really helps us further amplify this work. You can also support us by following us on our social platforms, signing up for our email list, rocking our new merch, joining our Patreon, or signing up for a workshop. So many options! Links to everything in the show notes and on our website, amplifyrj.com. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.